Shabbat Shalom and Chag Sameach. Good Sabbath. Happy Holiday. Nice to have you out there on the Holy Day. You were able to hear music. Daniel Kaplan, and we did get some positive response to that, so we thank you. We do appreciate the input we get, whether it be questions or comments, encouragement. We certainly appreciate all of that. And if you want to hear Daniel's music, you can download the service. It's available for you. And you can hear him live on Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, the seventh day of Unleavened Bread. April 15th, right? So forget your taxes and just enjoy the music of Daniel Kaplan and endure a sermon by yours truly. Okay. Hello, are you still out there? Are people still out there? Have we lost them? No, people are still listening. Sorry that the sound was not good initially. Hope that you heard what I said. And but now I realize it might have sounded faint. But no, I assure you that I'm lively and energetic and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And now the mic will illustrate that now. So a wave to the Drattlers. And hello to Connecticut and others who may be listening. Minnesota, Colorado, Oregon, California. We have listeners in those places. As you can tell here, there's a lot of excitement going on. What you hear is possibly Rebecca's baby. When Doobie and Rebecca's baby, when Rebecca was small, we lived in Pasadena, walking distance from services, and there were times we walked on the Sabbath to services, and when Rebecca was little, she'd roller skate to services. There was a fellow that was learning to roller skate, and people asked him, "What's the hardest part of learning a roller skate?" And he said, "The pavement." But Rebecca did well in that regard. You know, we've had a very historic week. Theologically speaking, there are a couple of things I want to comment on. Number one is the fact we had the first Seder in the White House, and I think that's not without worthy, you know, that's certainly worthy of note. I was surfing around the other day and came upon a comedian who wanted to comment on the Obama Seder, and there was a lot of inside humor there, you know, the kind of humor, that, let's say humor for the maybe more highly educated in our society. He had this fellow reporting. It looked like he was reporting in front of the White House, and the fellow had a kind of Arabic name. I don't know what his background is, but the comedian had this reporter in front of the White House, and he was talking about the Obama Seder. And he said, "You know, you think the Obamas would know a lot about Judaism, but not by the dumb questions they were asking." Like, why is this night different? Why are we eating unleavened bread? He said, really basic questions like that. And he said, not only that, the Seder wasn't even that well attended. There was one chair that was empty all night. You know, and then the comedian said, the only people who would get that joke aren't even watching because they're at a Seder. But anyway, the fella finished by saying, you know, maybe the Obamas will become Jewish. Then they can enjoy gefilte fish. And then he took some what he claimed was gefilte fish, put it in his mouth, and began to grimace. Yeah, not everybody loves gefilte fish, although many do. It's interesting in Israel. There's a rivalry between the Ashkenazic Jews and the Sephardic Jews, the European and the Mediterranean Jews. And one of the things that Sephardic Jews like to do is to attack gefilte fish because it's kind of a delicacy among the Ashkenazic Jews. I saw a movie about a Moroccan Jew who was invited to a European Jewish family's Friday night dinner, and they served him gefilte fish. And when they looked away, he hid it. He sneaked his hand under the table, fed the gefilte fish to the cat. You know, so that's kind of the rivalry that goes on. But that was worthy of note, having a Seder in the White House. The other thing that's, you know, far more significant in some ways, historically, at least for ourselves, you've heard of, I assume you've all heard of the Worldwide Church of God, those of you who are listening to this webcast. Well, the Worldwide Church of God now officially it has ended by that name, no longer uses that name. It is now the Grace Communion International. So I thought that's worthy of note. That's very interesting. Many of you, as I said, have heard of the Worldwide Church of God, and now it has a new name, Grace Communion International. So that may indicate some interesting historical development during the history of the church. Well, I'd like to be more positive. I'd like to get on to something more positive. I'm calling this talk, Christian Commandment Keepers are Members of the Family of God. This is what I want to talk about today. I didn't want to call it Focus on the Family, because then you might think I'm doing a program out of Colorado Springs or something. But I'm saying the Christian Commandment Keepers are members of the Family of God. Let's think about family today. This is the third day of Unleavened Bread. And Linda and I were married 38 years ago today. Now, the calendar has a 19-year cycle built into it. So usually the solar date and the lunisolar sacred date correspond every 19 years. So we were married on April 12, 1971, the 17th day of Nisan. Then 19 years later, those days coincided. And 57 years later, they will coincide. 3 times 19. This year, they almost coincide. Tomorrow will be the 12th, and today's the 11th. So they almost coincide. No calendar is absolutely perfect. Calendars have to be adjusted. Even the leap year is not perfect. It has to be adjusted. We have a leap year on the solar calendar every 4 years. That doesn't account for all the lost time. So there has to be an additional leap year, I think, after 400 years. So no calendar is absolutely precise. It seems that God deliberately put us in a situation where calendars have to be regulated by somebody. And so then you have the question of recognition of authority. And that's a lesson that some people have to learn. Well, all of us have to learn. I shouldn't say some people. All of us have to learn. But let's say some of us hopefully have inculcated that. But anyway, so today is a special day for us, and tomorrow on the Roman calendar, usually we celebrate both days, the third day of UB and April 12th, so we make a double whammy out of it. One year our children had a plaque put in. If those of you who've ever been to the Disney parks, and so many people have, you know that there are plaques where people have put in special dates in the history of their families, and many people put in their wedding date. And our children had a plaque put in near the entrance to Disney's California Adventure. They had a plaque put in giving our wedding date. And every year, thousands of tourists flock there, and many want to be photographed next to that plaque. No, I'm kidding. But it's there. For those of you in Southern California, if you're ever there, you can look it up. It's there. And we have, of course, a model of it in our home. God is very concerned with family. And one of those writers who illustrates this very powerfully is John, the Apostle John, because he often talks about God's people as children of God. And he has Christ using that terminology. If you read John's Gospel, that's something that John gravitated to. I'd like to go to 1 John 3. And also John liked to play with the Greek and Hebrew languages and the concept of gematria, the numerical values of letters. He wasn't the only one, but it seems that he had a certain inclination that way, as you'll see in a moment. But in 1 John 3, he says, "Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore the world does not know us, because it did not know him." So we are the children of God. If we're Christian Commandment Keepers, and when you think about that, what more wonderful destiny could you have than having a familiar relationship with God himself? Beloved, now we are children of God. Even now, we're not what we're going to become, but, you know, we have a young baby in the room. We had the blessing of the little child on the first day of Unleavened Bread, so he's quite young, obviously, young enough to be picked up by the minister, and who's also his grandfather. But the point is that he is not now what he's going to be in a couple of decades, and nor are we what we're going to eventually be. eons from now. You know, but we still are already children of God even now. Beloved, now we are children of God. And notice what it says. And it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So when Christ returns, then we're going to have the kind of life that he has, spirit life. And everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself, just as he is pure. That's what these days of unleavened bread are about. Living unleavened for 7 days, picturing that we're living righteously. A complete righteous life, 7 days. So we are children of God. There's, as I said, John worked with Gematria. There's some interesting things one can do with the Hebrew alphabet relating to family. I wanted to talk about family from several aspects today. Husband and wife, parents and children. You know, there are a lot of points that it could be brought out, but I'm trying to at the same time, you know, limit, because obviously one could go on and on. The Bible from cover to cover says so much about family that God is building a family. So I'm trying to limit it to a degree. And I wanted to make a couple of points about the Hebrew alphabet and about family. So let's go to Psalm 119. Psalm 119 has it all laid out. It's organized alphabetically according to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, many of you know this. This is review for perhaps most of you, but one never knows who's going to be listening. We're out there in the world of high tech or low tech nowadays, I guess it is, you know, because everybody has access to this now. So we're out there in, what do you call it, cyberspace. And whoever listens to this, Psalm 119 is organized alphabetically. It's called acrostic, an acrostic psalm. And it's organized so that the first 8 verses begin with Aleph, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The next 8 verses begin with Bet. And the next 8 verses begin with Gimel, and so on down the line. So here you have the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. All right, now, let's think about Adam and Eve. We're going to go back and forth from this psalm. But I want you to know that whenever you want to know the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, you can look at this psalm. In most Bibles, the letters are named. For example, I have in my Bible, over the first 8 verses, I have the word Aleph. Not only that, my Bible even shows me an Aleph. I even have an Aleph here, written. Now, some of your Bibles don't have an Aleph written. You just have the word Aleph. And a lot of you actually have a literal Aleph there, right? And then I have a Bet written, and then I have a Bet written there. So some of you have just the word, some of you have the actual word and the letter there. All right? So let's go to the story of Adam and Eve. This is a, you know, there's so much in this account, but I'll go with verse 2, chapter 2, verse 18. Of course, Adam has to do with the ground from which he came. Adam came from the ground, Adama, and Eve is Chava. Chava comes from the word for life, you know, Chaim. She's the mother of all living, so she's Eva, she's the living one. So here we have Adam and Chava, or Adam and Eve. And in Exodus, but we don't have Eve, that's the problem. You know, my son Daniel, you know, used to tell me, you know, when on Friday was Adam created? A little before Eve. But anyway, and hey, it's still got to grow it after all these years. All right? And those oldies but goodies. You know, you can't replace them. Anyway, in Genesis 2:18, and the Eternal God said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helper comparable to him." All right, human beings need to live basically as husband and wife. That's the ideal circumstance. It doesn't mean, you know, look at 1 Corinthians 7 if you want to see the advantages of being single. But basically, the Bible is pro marriage. Out of the ground of the Eternal God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the air and brought them to Adam to see what he would call them. And whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So he had gave him something to do. But in doing this, he noticed that they were paired, you know, and yet he had nobody. You know, the animals were in pairs, but not him. So Adam gave names to all cattle, to the birds of the air, to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. And the eternal God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam. So here, he does surgery on Adam. And the eternal God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. So it's very significant that he made it out of the rib of Adam, you know, basically comparable, somebody comparable to Adam. Then the rib which the eternal God had taken from, and then the rib which the eternal God had taken from man, he made into a woman, and he brought her to the man. And Adam said, "This, you know, behold, or here it says, this is now. Behold, hine, you know, what do the French say? You know, voila, you know, there it is. Voici, voila. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. You know, vive la différence, they say in French, right? She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife," right? Or the old King James said, cleave. So we used to talk about, you know, leaving and cleaving. "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." And remember, one is one. You know, you don't have to play games with the word one. It means one. So when they're together in that relationship, they are one flesh. They're two human beings. They're still two people, but they're one flesh. It doesn't say they're one person. They're two persons, but they're one flesh, because they have that kind of relationship. "And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed." So we have this honeymoon environment there at the Garden of Eden. Now, I want to take a look at the word for ish. I mean, the word for man, ish, and the word for woman, isha. Now, as I said, you can refer back to the Psalm 119 if you want. But the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet could be treated as an apostrophe in English. And if you wanted to do it right, it would be an apostrophe looking like a number 9. That's the typical apostrophe that we use. Looks like a 9. So we have the apostrophe. That's the aleph. Then the letter for man, and then after that would come the letter yud or y, and then would come sh, the letter shin. So that's how you spell man in Hebrew: aleph, yud, shin. And remember, the vowels were not written in those ancient times. So the word for man was ish. Aleph, yud, shin, or apostrophe y, sh. Now the word for woman is isha, and you add an h to ish. You put apostrophe y, sh, and then you add another h, and you read it isha. Is everybody with me? Ish is a man, isha is a woman. Now take the y from man, and take the h from woman, and now you have yh, yah, which is one of God's names, Yah. We say hallelujah, praise you the eternal. In the King James, it's spelled J-A-H. And I know in Jamaica, they make a big deal about God as Jah. For some reason, Jamaicans are into that, calling God Jah. So anyway, Yah is God's name. If you take God out of the relationship, what are you left with? Both names, the word for man, if you take the yud out, is apostrophe S-H, right? The word for woman, if you take the H out, is apostrophe S-H. Is everybody following me? Mm-hmm. All right, go back to the word for man. It's apostrophe Y-S-H. Now take out the Y. You have apostrophe S-H. Now go for the word for woman. It's apostrophe S-H-H. There's no Y in it. Now, I'm sorry, I missed that point initially. I didn't explain that. All right, good. I'm glad that was asked. The word for woman does not have the Y in it. It's just apostrophe S-H-H. But it's pronounced Isha, but there's no Y in it. Now everybody's clear. Good. So man is apostrophe Y-S-H. Woman is apostrophe S-H-H. So each name has three letters. Now let's take one letter out of each name. We take the Y out of man, and we have apostrophe S-H. We take the H out of woman, and we have apostrophe S-H. And if you, in Hebrew, are reading apostrophe S-H, you pronounce it Aish, and that's the word for fire. So man becomes Aish, fire, and woman becomes Aish, fire. So when you take out Yah, when you take God out of the relationship, you have strife. You have fire there. You have strife without a God-centered home. That's an interesting lesson. And my children, Beck and Doobie, tell me that they're listening to Dennis Prager and what he says about Genesis. I'll be interested to see whether or not he brings that point out in his, when he gets that far. You know, they're just beginning to listen to it. I'm not plugging it one way or the other. You know, I'm just saying that, I mean, there's a lot worse things you could listen to, I'll say that. You know, anyway, Dennis Prager gives a talk on the Pentateuch, on the Torah, and they're listening. It'd be interesting to see if he brings that point up. I wouldn't be surprised if he does. So that's one point regarding husband and wife, that, you know, it needs to be focused, you know, on we need to have a spiritual focus for a right relationship to be there. God was the author of marriage. God brought Eve to Adam. God said a man should leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. He is the author of marriage. It did not evolve. Humans didn't evolve the institution and invent it. God was the one that was the author of marriage. It's a divine institution. I'd like to continue on in this way again. With this time, I'm getting more deep into it. So let's go one level beyond. You know, one step beyond. You know, where few have gone before. I can't say we're going where no one has gone before, but where few have, maybe. And let's go to Psalm 119. Now let's look at Aleph and let's look at Bet. Aleph is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and Bet is the second letter. And they have a numerical value. The numerical value is 1 for Aleph, 2 for Bet. All right? So that makes the word Av, or father, then is equal to 3, right? Av, father, equals 3. Everybody with me? Mm-hmm. Now let's look at the letter Mem in the Bible. Mem. What you have to do is go to the verse 97. That's the 13th letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the letter Mem. Now once you get to letter 10, then the letters are worth 10, 20, 30, 40, etc. So since the letter 10 is worth 10, the 11th letter is worth 20, the 12th letter is worth 30, so Mem is worth 40. So the letter Mem is worth 40. Everybody with me? Mm-hmm. So let's take Aleph and Mem, M, which means mother. Av is father, M is mother. So mother is 41, Aleph Mem. And Av is 3, Aleph Bet. So together they make 44. Now, I already told you that Yod, the 10th letter of the Hebrew alphabet, equals 10. Now, look at where we are on page 885 of the New King James, or verse 89 of Psalm 119. You have the letter Lamed. Lamed equals 30. You just heard that Mem is 40, Lamed is 30. So Yud is 10, Lamed is 30. Now let's go back to verse 25 to the fourth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, Dalet. And that equals 4, of course. So you have Yud, Lamed, Dalet, which is the Hebrew word for a child. And a boy is Yalad, or Yeled, and the girl is Yalda. So Yud Lamed Dalet is a child in Hebrew, and it equals 10 for the Yud, 30 for the Lamed, 4 for the Dalet, 44. So interesting, isn't it? Father and mother come together, they equal 44, they have a child. Child also in Hebrew equals 44. It's interesting. I thought you might find that interesting. But we are children of God, and John dramatically points that out in chapter 21 of his gospel. Now, many of you are familiar with this, but some of you may not be. You may not be familiar with this passage I'm going to read. I know you're familiar with it, but in terms of the background to it. Everybody, all of you have read it, but not all of you necessarily know why you saw what you saw there. I'm in John 21. This is an amazing passage. Here, Christ prepares breakfast for his apostles. What a wonderful opportunity, imagine. Having your Lord and Savior prepare breakfast for you. And hopefully you enjoy fish, because it's going to be a breakfast of fish. But then these men were fishermen. And you know, fishermen do quite well. It's all net profit. All right. Another groaner. All right. Anyway, we're in John 21. And I was going to say that on the first day of Unleavened Bread, first of all, the night before we had our Leil Shemurim, our night to be much observed. We had our Seder, and then we had the blessing of Gideon, David, Mosley, and then we had a service. We had music. So we had a very fine use of that facility. And not only that, but the night before we had the New Testament Passover, we had the foot washing, we had the unleavened bread and wine, we had of course the New Testament Passover, which is critically important, by the way. I mean, it's not only by the way. That is a critically important observance that many have lost, and many do and don't understand what they're doing. Both are happening among people that we know. People whom we have, you know, been friends with over the years, attended services with over the years. Many of them have abandoned the New Testament Passover, or many of them are observing it in a way that is they're losing out some of the benefit because they don't know exactly what they're doing. Sorry to have to put it that way. But we had the New Testament Passover. We had the night to be much observed. We had the blessing of the little child. We had a service there, and it so happens that we needed a room to do all this in near where we lived, and what room do you suppose they gave us? Room 153. We found that inspiring. 153 is a number I talk about a lot. In fact, that's our website, CCK153, and it comes from John 21. Now, after these things, Jesus showed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and in this way he showed himself. Simon Peter, Thomas, that called the twin. Now his name was Twin. Now, why do you name your son Twin, Thomas? Why do you name your son Twin? Well, maybe he was one of two twins that survived. That's possible. It's good speculation that they had twins and one survived, and so they called him Twin. It's possible he was born in June, late June, early July, which the zodiac sign connected with that is Gemini. So they may have just named him after that. That doesn't mean that they think because of that he's going to become whatever or do whatever, you know. It doesn't mean that they tell the fortune by it, but they may have just decided to call him by the sign of the month. I wasn't there to advise him. But, you know, that's just speculation as to how he got that name. Anyway, then there's Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, you know, one of whom is writing this, you know, John and James, and one of them is the author of this gospel. And two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. So they're around the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Tiberias is another name for it. They said to him, we're going with you also. They went out and immediately got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But it's interesting that even though Christ had appeared to them, still they didn't quite get the point of what they were supposed to do about it. They were back fishing again. But when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. Then Jesus said to them, children, have you any food? Now you can imagine with John writing this, the children are going to come up. Because as I said, it's a very important theme in John's writings. So I just read it to you in 1 John 3. So he says, children, have you any food? They answered him, no. It kind of reminds me of German culture. Now, I don't know how many of you studied German. I know somebody here has. You know, when Germans want to be affectionate and warm and intimate with people, they call them Kinder. They call them children. When they want to just be, you know, warm with people, even if the people are old, not really children, but they call them Kinder to show that they like them. So it's kind of like that, maybe, how he calls them children. And he said to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. You know, they're looking for fish. So he says, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. And so they began to suspect something now. There's something special going on. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, which is John, you know, the author, said to Peter, it is the Lord. Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and plunged into the sea. Peter's personality, you know, just, what's the right word? Rambunctious? Whatever. Yeah. But the other, spontaneous, there's another, impetuous, is that a word? Mm-hmm. But the other disciples, that reminds me of a family whose two families, you know, their daughters went off to college, and one family said, you know, we're really impressed. Whenever our daughter sends us a letter, we have to go to the dictionary. And the other parent said, well, that's great, because whenever our daughter sends us a letter, we have to go to the bank. But anyway, in John 21:8, but the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, for about 200 cubits, perhaps as little as 300 feet, dragging the net with fish. Then as soon as they had come to land, they saw a fire of coals there, and fish laid on it, and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have just caught." Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to land full of large fish, 153. Oh. And although there were so many, the net was not broken. This is kind of funny, so I'll read this next verse. Jesus said to them, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. You know, they're afraid to even say anything yet. Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. So they had, you know, fish and bread at that time. But anyway, they caught 153 fish, and most of you know the reason. If you go back to Psalm 119, you know, you can work it out. So if you go back to Psalm 119, the word for children of God in Hebrew is B-N-Y, which is pronounced B'nai. And if you go back, you know, to your to Psalm 119, you'll find that B'nai is 62. And then the next term is Ha Elohim. But remember, we're not writing vowels, so we just write H, and then an apostrophe for the Aleph, and then an L, an H, a Yud, and an M. And we read it Elohim. You know, we have an H, we have an apostrophe, right? We have an L, we have an H, a Y, and an M. So H is 5, the apostrophe is 1, the lamed is 30. Somebody keeping track of this? Okay, the next H is 5, the next Y is 10, and the next M is 40. So what does that come out to? Ninety-one. So you have altogether 153. B'nai HaElohim, the children of God, which comes out to 153. So you see the gematria here. It's impressive because it's showing you that this is what we are to become, the children of God. And the fish that we gather, you know, as we go out into the world and God calls people through us and brings them into the church, chooses them through our ministry, we become fishers of men, and the fish we catch, in that sense, become children of God. So God is building a family. Of course, all of you know, in this room, I gave a sermon in 1994 in Niagara Falls. I said, God is building a family. The memory key is 153. Now, the relationship of God and the church is compared to that of a husband and a wife. And this time of year is the spring. It's the time of romance. And it's the time of romance between God and His people. This is when God called His people. This is when God began to court His bride, you know, in the spring of the year. In Jeremiah 2, we see that, how he brought us out of Egypt, and this was his way of, you know, marrying us and honeymooning with us and so on. In Jeremiah 2, "Moreover, the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Go and cry in the hearing of Jerusalem, saying, Thus says the Eternal, I remember you, the kindness of your youth, the love of your betrothal, when you went after me in the wilderness, in a land not sown." So, you know, we went after God into the wilderness, and it was a betrothal. It's very romantic. There's a lot of this romantic imagery when God talks about His relationship to Israel. You can also look at Ezekiel 16. He finds this abandoned baby girl. He works with it and raises it, and then eventually it becomes an adult, and then he in effect falls in love with the girl and marries the girl, but then she sins. You know, so you look at that imagery there in Ezekiel 16. But that is very powerful imagery found in the Bible, God's relationship to Israel as a bride and a groom, a husband and a wife, and Christ being the husband of the church being the bride of Christ. If you go to Ephesians, you find that imagery there. And of course, this is something that brides and grooms hear before they're married. In Ephesians 5 and verse 27, let's go to verse 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Christ as a husband gave everything for his church, his life, that he might sanctify and cleanse her with the washing of water by the word, that he might present her to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without blemish. So when Christ looks at us, he doesn't see the warts. He doesn't see the promises, the problems. He sees the potential that we have. He sees us in our best light. This is how spouses should see each other. Spouses should look at each other in their best light and focus on the positive of each spouse. You know, this is the example. And he goes through a whole discussion of the relationship of husband and wife. And finally, in verse 32, he says, "This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." So after going through all of this about husbands and wives, he then says, "All right, I've given you this instruction, but this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church." So the romantic parts of the Bible, you might say, the sexually explicit parts of the Bible, have two levels of understanding. One, of course, as you know, manuals for an affectionate marriage, and two, as spiritually, speaking of a relationship of Christ and the church. Now, today on this Sabbath, during the days of unleavened bread, in synagogues, in Orthodox synagogues, they'll be reading Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, because this is the time to renew that relationship with God, that romantic relationship with Christ, Christ and the church. I want to read a couple of passages out of Song of Solomon that tie in, you know, with the Gospels. First, you know, since we're in the New Testament still, probably, let's go to the book of Revelation. Now, what I wanted to point out to you was, if you want to get a very effective translation of Song of Solomon, I would recommend the Moffat translation. James Moffat was a Scottish scholar who wrote a translation of the Bible that was a hot bestseller during his lifetime, which would be the early 20th century. And one reason perhaps it did not catch on is because he did get a bit arrogant and begin to rearrange some of the verses. And so some people probably feel a bit uncomfortable with his translation because it doesn't absolutely follow the versification in most translations. He took some liberties, putting a verse here and a verse there. But it's a very effective translation and in many ways. And I wanted to take a look at Song of Solomon in this translation, a couple of verses, a few verses. But first, let's go to Book of Revelation. Again, remember that John's writing this, who, as I said, put a very great emphasis on family life and comparing Christ as the husband of the church and talking about the church as children of God. In Revelation 22:20, it says, "He who tested..." Well, let's go back a few verses so we get the context here. Let's go to verse 17. Revelation 22:17. "And the Spirit and the Bride say, Come." So here God's Spirit is instigating the return of Christ, but also on earth, the Bride is praying, inspired by the Spirit. The church is praying. The Bride is praying, Come. It's like, you know, perhaps a bride and the wedding day is coming, and the groom perhaps is away on a trip or doing some business or whatever, and the bride is waiting for the groom to come so they can have the wedding. "And the Spirit and the Bride say, Come, and let him who hears say, Come, and let him who thirsts come. Whoever desires, let him take the water of life freely." Verse 20, "He who testifies to these things says, Surely I am coming quickly. Amen. Even so, come, Lord Jesus." So Christ, inspired by God, of course, says, "Even so, come, Lord Jesus. Amen. Even so, come, Lord Jesus." And if you go to the end of Song of Solomon, if you want to turn there, I want to read it in the Moffat because it brings it out more, what's going on here. Let me read. This is Song of Solomon 8, And hopefully it's verse 13 and 14 in your versions. You have the same verses as Moffat? All right, I'm going to read what Moffat says. He says, My comrades, hear your voice, girl, in the garden haunt. Ah, let me hear it too. And then the girl says, hasten then, O my darling. Play like a roe or a hart upon my scented slopes. So it's rather clear what she's asking him to do. And, you know, so she wants that intimacy there with the husband. She's calling for it. And so that's the physical side. And the spiritual side is what you read in Revelation. Now, we saw that when Christ looks at the church, he sees it without spot, without blemish. You can also see this in Song of Solomon. I want to go to Song of Solomon, the fourth chapter. First, I want to set the tone in the second chapter, that this is the spring of the year. It's the time in the Middle East when the rains have ended, when people can go outside and can have these romantic strolls through the park and so on. And this is Song of Solomon 2 and verse 10. My beloved spoke and said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grapes give a good smell. Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. You know, so it's the spring of the year when young men think about baseball, you know, but obviously with a, you know, we're talking about here romance. I'm joking. This is the season of Twitter patient, as we would say around here in Orlando, Disney country. I'd like to go to Song of Solomon 4 and verse 7. And here's what he says, as I said, from Ephesians. Song of Solomon 4, 7. He says, you are all fair, my love, and there is no spot in you. So we have this concept that when the man looks at the woman, he doesn't, you know, it's not like, unfortunately, what John Adams did one time. Now, I don't want to complain about their relationship. It's none of my business. It's just that I know a lot about him because he's a historical figure. He one time wrote a letter to Abigail, and they had a wonderful relationship. But he wrote a letter to Abigail pointing out her various faults. And I'm thinking, why would he, you know, what do you want to do that for? But, you know, how they relate to one another, I guess, is their business. You know, but that's not, you know, but I would recommend when you think about your spouse, you think about the positive traits. And it says here, you know, is that when the husband says to the wife, you are all fair, my love, there's no spot in you. That's how I would recommend that you think about one another. Now, I'd like to go to a couple of passages and show you why I think Moffat has really caught the spirit of the book. Let's go to Song of Solomon 2 and verse 7. There's a chorus that you read in the book that occurs three times in the book. And the first time is found in Song of Solomon 2, verse 7. Now, you look at it in your translation, and I'll read it in the Moffat. Here's what the Moffat says for Song of Solomon 2, verse 7. It says, O maidens of Jerusalem, I charge you, by the roe deer and the hinds, never rouse lovers, never stir them, till they are satisfied. It's a little different, a little more explicit than what you have. You know, and I think he caught the concept of the book. One other passage, and that's in the seventh chapter. And again, hopefully you can read some translation that you have, chapter 7, and now I'll read it in Moffat. And again, I think he's catching the actual meaning here. This is Song of Solomon 7 in the Moffat. How neatly you trip it, O princess mine. Your thighs are swaying like links of a chain that a master hand has molded. You know, so you see what's being talked about. You know, this is, of course, a PG-rated part of the sermon. So you see, you know, so as I said, and this time of year is a time to refocus on that in a relationship, in a marriage, obviously, and obviously not outside. You know, obviously anything outside is inappropriate, to use an understatement. But within, you know, this is a time to focus on that, and also to get the spiritual focus of Christ and the church. This is a time to renew your commitment to the church. That's why we have these, one of the reasons we have these holy day seasons. I'd like to conclude this aspect of what I'm talking about by going to Hosea. This is another passage that I usually read when I do a wedding. I had the opportunity, of course, to do Daniel and Megan's wedding, and I believe I and I read this passage then. In Hosea 2, now when Orthodox Jews put on their tefillin, their phylacteries, when they wind the leather strap around the finger of the hand, it's like an engagement ring between Israel and God, and they read these verses. This is a promise of marriage from God to Israel, which is a threefold promise in seven steps. It's a threefold promise in seven steps. It's beautiful, you know, beautiful literature. So I'm in Hosea 2:19. He says, "I will betroth you to me forever." So the first thing he says is it's forever. And there are seven stages, the first being that it's forever. And you see the word betrothed is there three times in the passage. So he betroths her, it's mentioned three times, and it's 7 points. "I will betroth you to me forever, yes. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice and loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the eternal." And the word here, "you shall know the eternal," that's the same verb as you find in Genesis when it's talking about sexual intercourse. So-and-so knew his wife, and they, you know, she conceived and had a child and so on. It's the same term, you know. So it's talking about having an intimate relationship with God as husband and wife, talking collectively of the church. It's symbolic, obviously, you know, now spiritually speaking. So this time of year, you know, we can think about that. Think about renewing our relationship with our spouse, and also with our children, you know, the family ties, and with even other relatives. You know, we had my mother came down here and visited just right before the Passover. The great grandmother of Gideon came down, and then before her, for that matter, you know, Doobie's mother came down. The great grandmother on the other side of the family came to visit Gideon. Pardon? Oh no, she's just the grandma. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to age her beyond, you know. She's, you know, it's a good thing. If she ever hears this talk, I'm in big trouble. No, she's quite youthful, actually. I don't know why I thought of her as a great-grandma. Just, you know, because I'm, you know, speaking off the cuff here. You know, those of you who are here sitting here know I don't use notes when I speak. I want to keep that spontaneity. You know, I don't want to just read a message. I read scriptures. I don't do the scriptures by memory normally, but I do speak without notes. So anyway, we had the grandmothers here, and then we had the great grandmother here on one side of the family. You know, so this is a time, as I said, for renewal, family renewal, church renewal. And there's an interesting story in the Bible, that ties in, and that is the story of Isaac and Rebekah. I want to go back to Genesis 24. Isaac is a type of Christ. He was monogamous his entire life. He lived 180 years, and all of the time that he was married to Rebekah, she was his only woman, with whom he had that kind of relationship, his only wife. He never was polygamous. And of course, Rebekah was always his, you know, she always had the one husband, Isaac. And it's interesting that she came to Isaac because God had intervened in a way that showed her that it was the right thing to do to marry him. So she married him on faith. He didn't go up and date her and court her and woo her and lead her away. That's not wrong. I mean, that's a fine way to do it. But in her case, she was impressed enough to, on faith, go down and be willing to marry him. So she set an example for the church, because we're, of course, committed to Christ on faith in the same way. You know, we weren't there in the first century. We didn't directly deal with him as the apostles did. You know, we're dealing with him on faith as Rebekah dealt with Isaac. So anyway, the account is here in Genesis 24. And maybe what I'll do to save time is just summarize that Abraham made his servant swear that he would do all he could to get a wife for Isaac from Abraham's family. That he would go back to where Abraham had come from and find a wife, you know, from Abraham's family. And if you'll notice, Abraham's family had a relationship with the God of Abraham, that they spoke about Yahweh, the Eternal, the God of Abraham. And so even though there were differences in their approach to things, but evidently they did have that have a certain religious belief in common, in that Abraham worshipped Yahweh, the true God, as did his family there north in the north in Syria. They also worshipped the true God, though they may have mixed it up and they may have been more polytheistic, but at least they understood about Yahweh, and that was something that they had in common. And that, I suppose, that was a critical factor in why he wanted a wife from for Isaac from there. So anyway, notice that when the servant saw Rebekah, he had prayed for a sign, and God gave him the sign. Just what he prayed for, God gave him. This is in verse 14. Well, I'll just skip. I'll skip what he asked for, because it's going to come up in a moment anyway. Let's go verse 15. And it happened before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, oh, so she's a relative, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. Now remember, I talked about baseball earlier. So you see, Rebekah walked with a pitcher on her way to the well. No, okay, anyway, we're sorry about that. Verse 16. I'm not sorry, really. Verse 16. Now the young woman was very beautiful to behold, a virgin, no man had known her, and she went down to the well, filled her pitcher, and came up. So, you know, the servant noticed everything, you know, and he said, you know, so far she fits the bill. She's beautiful on the outside, beautiful on the inside, everything's going just great. But is she from Abraham's family? Because that was part of the deal. And the servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your pitcher. So she said, drink, my lord. Then she quickly let her pitcher down to her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw water for your camels also, until they have finished drinking. Wow. She even had this concern for his animals. So you see, that's important. You care about animals as well. And you go above and beyond in your generosity. And that was a sign that he looked for. So he was just amazed. And then comes the real exciting news that she's also related to Abraham. Verse 23, and said, whose daughter are you? Tell me, please, is there room in your father's house for us to lodge? So she said to him, I am the daughter of Bethuel, Milcah's son, whom she bore to Nahor. Moreover, she said to him, we have both straw and feed enough and room to lodge. Then the man bowed down his head and worshipped the Eternal. Everything had gone as he had prayed. Perfect, you know. Beautiful, wonderful character, related, you know. Check, everything checks. You know, matchmaker, make me a match. You know, this really worked out great. And he said, blessed be the Eternal God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, being on the way, the Eternal led me to the house of my master's brethren. Now, to skip ahead, notice that they understood when he explained to them what happened, that this was God's doing. Now, let's face it, they had their motives. He emphasized how wealthy Abraham was, and he brought goodies with him. So, Laban, you know what kind of man Laban was, if you know the Bible. Laban was a very mercenary kind of guy. And Laban saw in this, wow, I'm going to have a rich in-law now, you know. And Rebecca was his sister. He was taking care of her as her brother, and he knew now that he was going to be connected to this wealthy family, and he was going to be getting, benefiting from it. So that, you know, that was a lot of what motivated him. But at the same time, you see, they referred to God as they talk about it. Let's go to verse 50. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, so Bethuel is still alive here, but Laban seems to have a special concern for his sister. But Bethuel, you know, is still alive at this point. So Laban and Bethuel are speaking. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing comes from the Eternal. We cannot speak to you either bad or good. You know, so they understood that this was God's doing, and they refer to God as Yahweh, the Eternal. And however, Rebekah still had to voluntarily be willing to do it. Look at verse 38. Then they called Rebekah and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." So she willingly went. As I said, she made that commitment on faith. And I think she understood what was going on here, that this was a righteous man, that this was a God-fearing family, that they were concerned with having God-fearing offspring, and that this was the right thing for her to do. Verse 59, so they sent Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men. So she evidently was quite young, but she still had somebody go with her to take care of her. She had like a maid to go with her named Deborah. You see, she's mentioned later by name. So they sent away Rebekah, their sister, and her nurse, and Abraham's servant and his men, and they blessed Rebekah and said to her, "Our sister, may you become the mother of thousands, of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gates of those who hate them." So they saw that this was a special relationship. A nation was being built here. And this prophecy actually affects world news to this very day. I don't have time to go into it now. But this is a prophecy that even to this day has an impact on our lives. But what they saw was happening here is that a family was being built. And this was a special providential event. And when a couple gets together, they need to think about that. They need to. I know we have American songs, "Just You and I." I mean, you know, and that's okay to do. But remember, when a couple gets together, they're representing also families. They have a heritage. Both the husband and the wife have not only a heritage but a future. There could be offspring. There's a future, or the impact of their own lives. If nothing else, if they don't have offspring, they're going to have a life together which will impact the world. And they also have a heritage. So I would like to go back to a great Jewish philosopher who I disagree with on an awful lot of points, but nevertheless I want to cite him on this point. His name is Mordecai Kaplan. So maybe he's a distant relative, very famous Jewish philosopher. I did get to see him speak. He lived to be over 100 years old, and at some point in that life I got to see him speak when I was rather young. But he made a comment. He said, "Our ancestors have a vote in what we do, but not a veto." I think that's appropriate. In other words, keep in mind that you have a heritage. It doesn't mean that you absolutely, that they absolutely control what you do from the grave, but you have to respect your heritage, and also you have to look forward to your potential. And when you marry, it's not just two people. Yes, it is, but it's also, a background and a future that you have to consider. And they certainly did here. So she comes to see Isaac. Then Rebekah and her maids arose, and they rode on the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac came from the way of Beer Lahai-Roi, for he dwelt in the south. This is a place where God had appeared to Hagar years ago. And Isaac went out to meditate in the field in the evening. And he lifted his eyes and looked, and there the camels were coming. Then Rebekah lifted her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from her camel. If you have maybe another translation, even though there were no cigarettes in those days, but you could say she alighted off her camel. Now, that's a real groaner. All right, anyway, then Rebekah lifted her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from her camel. For she had said to the servant, "Who is this man walking the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took a veil and covered herself. So her first reaction was to get a little bit shy and a little bit maybe tense and very respectful when she comes to Isaac. He's the kind of person that, when you saw him, you saw he was a very, very devout person, very wise person, and one to be respected. Evidently, he just had that aura about him, and so she reacted in that way. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done, and so Isaac, of course, went along with the decision. Of course, I'm sure he was impressed with her. Once she took the veil off, he probably was quite impressed. But anyway, then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. I'm sure he would have also been impressed with the fact that she was willing to come down there and become his wife. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So the relationship grew. She became his wife, and he loved her. And they were monogamous their whole life together. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. And so this was a type, as I said, of Christ and the church. The church comes to Christ on faith, and Christ, of course, loves the church. So this Isaac and Rebekah account is a powerful imagery to keep in mind at this time of the year. I want to finish by going to the book of Ephesians, Ephesians the third chapter. I had meant to read this in the Greek, I still might. I have a Greek text here. So let's go to the book of Ephesians. And while you're turning to Ephesians 3, I'm going to see if I can turn to Ephesians 3 in the Greek. Okay, let's see. Greek. I'm sorry, Ephesians. Not the book of Greek, but the book of Ephesians. Let's see. I want Ephesians 3, verse 15. Okay, is this Ephesians 3? All right, Ephesians 3, verse 15. Now, the word for family here is patria. And if you look at the word for father in Ephesians 3, 14, the word for father is patera. So you see that the word father gives us the word for family, that the word for family used here in Ephesians is based on the word for father. And so it's a play on words. It may be Greek to me, but it's a play on words. Ephesians 3:14. For this reason I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. And he takes that word father, and from that word he gives the word family, which is based in Greek on father. From whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. You see, God is the origin of family. God is the father of the family. Jesus Christ is our elder brother. The church is the bride of Christ. We are the children of God. The family is analogous to our relationship with God. From whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might through his Spirit in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is their width and length and depth and height, to know the love of Christ which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. And then Paul continues on in this long doxology. Now to him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, to him be glory in the church by Christ Jesus to all generations, forever and ever. Amen. Christian commandment keepers are members of the family of God. Thanks very much for listening. Have a wonderful Sabbath and a wonderful Festival of Unleavened Bread. Again, I would like to remind you, you can listen live, 3 p.m. on Wednesday. And, of course, a week from today, God willing, 3 p.m. again, the next Sabbath service after the holidays are over. Let me also mention, too, that tomorrow is the first day of the week after the Sabbath, and therefore the first unleavened Sunday, if you want to look at it that way. We'll use the English, call it Sunday. The first unleavened Sunday, which means tomorrow is the day number one counting towards Pentecost. It's a very important day. It's the day Christ ascended to his Father. The resurrected Christ ascended to God. And it was at the time that they were offering the Omer in the temple, the wave sheaf, the barley offering, the beginning of the barley harvest in the Middle East or in ancient Israel. So we have wave sheaf is tomorrow, which means tomorrow is day number one. It's the day that Christ ascended to his Father, and it's the day we begin counting towards Pentecost. This year, Pentecost is May 31st. If any of you want to drop in at that time, you know, we'll be having Sabbath services, and of course, Pentecost services Sunday, May 31st. In the meantime, all the best to you and yours.